This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to NSPS Radio Hour. Today, our guest is Greg Winton with the Aviation Law Firm. Welcome, Greg.
Good morning. Welcome.
Before we get into our conversation, our government affairs consultant has asked me to follow up on a couple of things that we're doing. On Friday, for all listeners who are members of NSPS, we sent out an action alert related to the Federal Land Asset Inventory Reform Act, known as the FLARE Act, urging our members to contact their legislators in the House to vote positively on this Bill 196, House Resolution, 916, when it comes up on Wednesday. We'll probably be sending out another alert on that, but I wanted to let everybody know about it. If you're listening and didn't receive this, then shoot an email to me at curtis.sumner@nsps.us.com. The other thing on government affairs that just happened at the end of the week, three legislators have written to Labor Secretary Perez regarding our Davis-Bacon Act issue, and it's been a year now since we and they have asked for information that hasn't really been forthcoming, and so we're looking to get some action to rescind AAM 212 until such time as this is all worked out in a logical manner. So we'll be sending out a news release on that, but I just want to let everybody know that that's happening at the moment. So with that, then we will go ahead and introduce our audience to Greg Winton. Greg, maybe you could tell our audience a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Sure. Thank you much. Well, I started my career 25 years ago as an attorney for the Federal Aviation Administration, both at the regional office in New York and then down at headquarters in Washington, D.C., and then I became a litigation attorney for the U.S. Department of Justice Aviation Litigation Division, where we defended the United States as employees involving major air disasters and accidents. For the past 15 years, I've been in private practice, again, exclusively dealing with aviation-related issues. And for the last 2 years, I've been named the general counsel for aviation law purposes for the Management Association of Professional Photometric Surveyors, MAPS. So become quite familiar over the last couple of years with all of the surveying issues related to aviation with regard to certification of aircraft systems that are used by the MAPS members, and most recently the use of UAS or unmanned aircraft systems for aerial acquisition and aerial survey. As of late, the FAA is now opening their doors to allow petition for exemption for the use of a commercial unmanned aircraft system for survey and other purposes. As of yet, they have not approved any use of a UAS or unmanned aircraft system for commercial purposes. However, those petitions have been filed. And we're waiting eagerly to hear the first approval, and hopefully that will be forthcoming within the next 120 days or so.
So what types of folks would pursue that other than people we know about? I mean, surveyors, mappers.
Sure. The use of an unmanned aircraft system is not new to the world in technology. Certainly people are using them in Canada, they're using them in Europe, use South America, and quite efficiently and effectively. I mean, we're talking about aerial acquisition, aerial survey, certainly one platform in which we can use an unmanned aircraft. But unmanned aircraft can be used in agricultural applications. So if you take a crop duster, which is the typical manned aircraft operation, we have issues involving overspray because it's a vast spraying of an area over a farm. But if you take a small radio-controlled helicopter-type aircraft with GPS technology, you can get a lot closer to the ground, a lot more precision spraying, have no overspray, no waste, and certainly a less of a carbon footprint, because these generally are either small gas engines or electric. So it really helps out along the way in many respects.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I I think I was talking to John about this when we were on the show last week, the whole idea of crop treatment, in my mind, goes back 2 years ago when I was doing some work with, I wasn't working for, but doing some work with an aerial firm, and they were just then beginning to use satellite information to try to figure out those areas that, like you were talking about, those specifically targeted areas that need help where the whole field may not. Of course, they didn't have UAVs then, so they still had to figure out how to treat them without over-treating, I suppose. But it's just interesting how, as these things evolve, it's almost like everything gets into the picture. And I know from the surveyor side of things, one of the things we've talked about for a long time is this the whole idea of small site surveys. You know, like I mentioned, I think, to John last week about years ago, I did a lot of surveys on gas stations that were going to be turned into convenience stores or sites that were going to be Wawa's or Sheets or, you know, whatever, 7-Elevens, whatever they're going to be. And getting all the detail, particularly if it's an existing site, is a pretty big undertaking. And even back then, we were thinking, boy, if we had something that could just hover over this one little spot and gather all this information, that would make things go much more quickly. So it looks like we're getting closer to that reality, doesn't it?
Hopefully. You know, and also some of the more dangerous operations, fire rescue, you know, putting out large forest fires, if you do that with an unmanned aircraft system rather than risking lives, be a lot safer, a lot smarter, a lot more efficient. And the same thing with, you know, pipeline surveys, things like that go over water for many miles and many hours. It's safer to put an unmanned aircraft system out there as well.
Sure. And I could see the thing in the fire, too, because, again, that's in a whole different context, of course. It's kind of like the crop dusting. They're taking planes and dropping chemicals over a pretty broad area, hoping to hit the fire, I guess. But something like this could be more targeted, I suppose.
Yeah, I think we're a good the time away from allowing that through the FAA, but certainly there's the applications we can be using this technology.
Oh, yeah, that's certainly true. And so I guess before we get into, if somebody's interested in doing this, you know, what steps would they take? Maybe a little bit of background on where things are with the FAA. What are they, you know, how far away are we, or exactly what are they working on now?
Well, right now, the FAA has taken a position that the commercial use of an unmanned aircraft system is prohibited. Interestingly enough, if we look at the regulatory scheme that the FAA has in place, it only addresses, obviously, the technology from the 1950s or so when the regulations were drafted concerning manned aircraft. So there really is no regulation on the book today that you can read that says, in essence, thou shalt not operate an unmanned aircraft system for commercial purposes. So what has the FAA done? In one particular case, a gentleman was operating a UAS for commercial purposes, or so the FAA deemed it was, in Virginia, and they brought a civil penalty action against that individual. The one regulation that they cited was the sort of catch-all regulation of 14 CFR, which is Code of Federal Regulation, Section 91.13A, and what that says basically is no person may operate an aircraft in a careless or reckless manner so as to endanger the life or properties of others. So, again, very broad, very catch-all. It doesn't talk about UAS, but they brought that action. Lo and behold, they go before an administrative law judge who works for the National Transportation Safety Board, who hears the appeals of these enforcement actions by the FAA, and a law judge, without even a trial, summarily dismissed on a summary judgment motion the FAA's case, saying that the FAA does not have regulatory authority to regulate the use of an unmanned aircraft system. Very interesting, very, you know, landmark decision as far as the law judge is concerned. Lo and behold, the FAA has since appealed that law judge's decision. The appeal now is sitting before the full National Transportation Safety Board. My experience as of late, the NTSB is running about 4 to 6 months in time before they would render a decision, so we're probably about 4 months out before getting a final decision from the NTSB, and they can do one of three things. They can either affirm the law judge and say that's true, the FAA doesn't have regulatory authority. They can reverse the law judge and say, no, the FAA does have regulatory authority, and therefore there is a violation and a civil penalty will be paid. They can also remand the case back to the law judge for further consideration, for further evidence, or further findings of fact. Remember, trial never did take place, so they may remand it to the judge and say, have a full evidentiary hearing where witnesses and evidence will go into the record. And actually, there's a fourth option where they can modify the judge's decision and sort of split the baby, so to speak, and maybe a violation with no civil penalty, just as an example. So everybody's sort of very curious and waiting on bated breath as far as what the NTSB will do with that law judge decision. Keep in mind, regardless of the NTSB decision, either party, if unsatisfied, can then appeal again to the United States Circuit Court of Appeals, which in the hierarchy of the court system is literally one court level below the United States Supreme Court. So it'll get up there pretty high pretty fast. And, you know, it'd be interesting if the Supreme Court, you know, decides to take this case and hears it.
So I'm just sitting here thinking as we're talking this through, and you were talking about the person in Virginia who was using the equipment. And so is there any way that NTSB or FAA or anybody gets in and restricts sales on these things, or can you just, you can buy them but not use them?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, right? So you can sell them, you can buy them, but you can't use them, at least commercially for right now. Now, if you're just a recreational model flyer, right, a remote control aircraft that have been around for ages and they're still out there now, and you know, some of these are pretty sophisticated. I mean, you could put a small dog in one of some of these remote control aircraft, and they'd be able to take off and fly. Now, you know, you're supposed to fly them below 400 feet. You're supposed to be away from, you know, an operating airport with a control tower. And so if you're flying it over your own land for personal purposes, then you can buy and use these all day long. So it's when you go into the commercial enterprise that it becomes suspect as far as the FAA is concerned. Now, keep in mind, again, these things are flying every day. And I know for a fact a lot of the real estate agencies now, commercial and also residential agents, are requesting photographs and video be taken of houses and buildings that are listed for sale, and they're being taken by use of an unmanned aircraft system.
Wow. We got to go to our first break. Maybe we can pick up. That's an interesting topic. So when we come back from the break, maybe we can talk about that a little bit.
Fantastic.
Attention surveyors, are you aware that yellow stick you're using is saving lives all over the world? Yes, that pinfinder is clearing fields and villages of unexploded cluster bombs and other hidden explosives in over 25 countries. Johnstead, in cooperation with International Mine Action Programs, provides free locators to where they are most urgently needed. To find out how you can help, visit the NSPS website at nsps.us.com. And thank you.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on americaswebradio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on americaswebradio.com anytime you like.
Quick stakes are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden stakes, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about quick stakes, go to www.quickstake.com or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
You're listening to americaswebradio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We're back with Greg Winton today, and we're talking about legal aspects with regard to unmanned aerial vehicles and systems. It was kind of interesting when you were going to break, Greg, you were talking about the real estate industry beginning to utilize this. I guess it's another tool in their arsenal for being able to show properties, I suppose. I know the Google Earth and all those kind of things have been really popular for that type of thing. So I guess this is an even more detailed look maybe at properties.
Oh, yeah, especially that I've seen in the waterfront property market, you know, to get that bird's eye view, so to speak, of a house and how it's situated with the view, it's just tremendous. And, you know, to hire an aircraft or a helicopter to do that would be cost ineffective. And so, you know, you can go to any shopping mall and, you know, there's a kiosk set up with somebody operating, you know, a remote control helicopter or, you know, Brookstone, and go get one of these that you can operate with your iPad or your smartphone. And all you need to do is put one of these small video cameras on it, and, you know, there you go. You've got an unmanned aircraft system that can take video.
When I was talking to John last week, he made mention of the fact that to be able to utilize the equipment for mapping purposes, for what MAPS members do or what our members might do, a pilot's license is required. So is that not the case with what the real estate folks are doing?
To my knowledge, the real estate folks are not using licensed pilots to operate these unmanned aircraft systems. So, you know, keep in mind, I did mention earlier that to date, the FAA has not approved the commercial use of UAS. They actually have, I think it was in the last 2 weeks, there's an operation up in Alaska or the Arctic where they are allowing an aircraft unmanned with a LIDAR system, which is used to do topographical surveying. And so that was the first test bed that the FAA allowed. My understanding that a commercial pilot, a licensed pilot, is operating that aircraft.
Yeah, and that would make sense. I know on the photogrammetry side, where people use, you know, just normal planes or helicopters, that's pretty much always been the case before. And that's, as I said, John mentioned that last time, that those of us who are in the surveying business wouldn't necessarily be able to just go out and buy one of these things and start flying our topo maps. We'd have to have somebody in charge who had a pilot's license.
Well, again, yeah, if you're going to do it commercially, the FAA is going to require that. But keep in mind, the regulations are not drafted yet. So we were told during a meeting at FAA headquarters within the last couple of months that the office that's in charge of administering the regulatory scheme is going to be issuing a notice of proposed rulemaking by the end of 2014, so sometime before the end of December. And that's the first step in the administrative process where regulations are drafted for the first time. The agency puts out this notice. It's published in the Federal Register for all to see. It's open for a comment and note period, so the public and industry can comment in writing to the agency, and then the agency considers all those comments and comes up with either a proposed final rule or the actual regulation itself.
Does that process open the door at all for the legislatures to get involved in any way, or is this all agency-based?
Yeah, this is the Administrative Procedure Act. It really dictates how that is done, and that's a congressional mandate. Congress has already told the FAA in 2012 in the FAA Modernization and Reform Act that they shall come up with this regulation with regard to use of UAS in the national airspace system. So Congress has said its piece, and now it's up to the regulatory body, the FAA, to go ahead and draft with the comments from the public. So that's where we're at now.
Yeah, I guess the reason I was asking that question is it seems as though these days, if somebody has an issue with something, they try to get the Congress involved, whether they should be or not. So
right.
I was just curious if that was even a possibility.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's kind of interesting. You know, we do have regulations, like I said, that have been in place concerning the use of manned aircraft, both in the private, public, and commercial realm. And Congress has stepped in recently, and actually the President signed into law 2 years ago in August the Pilot's Bill of Rights. So we had this regulatory scheme. It had been working since, like I said, the late 1950s. And then Congress said, well, wait a minute. Some of these regulations and the procedures in which the regulations are enforced, meaning pilot enforcement actions, suspensions, revocations of pilot certificates, is not necessarily fair to the airmen. So they came up with some law, and the president signed it, and so it affected the way in which the FAA now can enforce those regulations against pilots. Very interesting.
Not being a flyer myself, I have some friends who are flyers, but I've never asked this question. If one were a licensed pilot, let's say somebody owned a small single-engine plane or something, and they had a license to operate that plane, would that allow them to do the UAV thing, or do you have to have some other type of qualification?
Well, again, remember, there are not any regulations affecting it right now. So right now, anybody can go ahead and buy, you know, was really just a remote-controlled aircraft, UAS, slap a camera on it and use it. You don't need to be a licensed pilot. Well, I think what the FAA has told me, at least in meetings behind closed doors at headquarters, is if you're going to be requesting an exemption to operate UAS commercially, we would require that the person have at least a commercial pilot certificate. But, you know, to buy one today and fly one over your own property, you don't need any pilot qualifications whatsoever or pilot training.
Okay. Well, that's interesting information for people to know, whether they want to do that or not, I guess is another question, but it's interesting for them to know that, because I developed the wrong thought about that when I was chatting earlier, that it might be something, but I understand that this whole rule, this process is still going on in terms of making the rules for how this is going to work. You talked about the thing in Alaska. That was a little bit intriguing, and, of course, topography is a big deal in the surveying community. Do you know if that is that a federal project, or do you know if it's a private project, or do you have any idea?
You know, I, off the top of my head, I don't recall. I did read the specifics of it when it was first it went public, but so you know, I apologize on that. I do believe it may be for public service, but again, it's not just two private companies working together to do this work. But right now, when a public entity, whether it be law enforcement or the federal government, needs survey work, they are granted what the FAA has been giving is a certificate of authorization, or COA, or waiver. And with this COA, the public entity can go and acquire a UAS or obtain a company that will manage and operate the UAS for this public entity, and it's approved that way under the COA. What I'm talking about, and what I was talking about earlier, is actually commercial enterprise, just like we have some of our MAPS members now, where they go out and they get hired and they go ahead and they fly a manned aircraft and do the survey work and sell the service. That can't be done right now with the UAS unless you have this authorization by the FAA.
Right. Yeah, I guess one of the things that we always get into that's out of your realm a little bit, but just as a point of interest, one of the things we always get involved with is the difference between private sector work and public sector work, and who's allowed to do what. And of course, the guys on the private side think the government folks have advantages that they don't have. And what you just described sounds kind of like one of those.
Yeah, it sounds like it, right. It certainly is.
And so, in other words, they could go out and hire a firm who has the capability, who couldn't do it on their own without it being a government contract, if I'm understanding this correctly. So
it's exactly the way it works right now. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So that adds another little dimension to it, I suppose, looking at how that works. The reason I was asking about Alaska, of course, we've got members up in Alaska, and so we may have some excited folks up there who might get involved in that kind of a project. And so I was curious about it, because maybe some of John's members over at MAPS, or even our members at NSPS, might end up being involved in that project, or one like it, I guess, if they're going on in different parts of the country. So if I understood correctly, even in that case, for this particular purpose, do they then have to go back in each case and get approval, or is that certificate of authorization a blanket thing for an agency, or is it on a job-by-job basis, or do you know that?
Yeah, it's very specific as to, one, the aircraft. So we've been told that the FAA wants not only the model of aircraft, but the serial number. So it's for a specific aircraft and a specific operation, where we've been told that we want to know the geometry, you know, give us the latitude, longitude of where you're going to be operating this aircraft and the altitudes and the time. So it's very specific to each. You're not going to get a blanket authorization at this time.
Right. Yeah. And again, getting back to that, you know, the public-private side of things, if one part of that equation is able to move ahead, then they would have the ability to gather a lot of data that could then be, I don't know if the government would resell data or not, but at least use the data, and that private sector at this point in time wouldn't be able to do on their own, as an independent entity. So kind of raises issues in people's minds, too. So we won't solve all those issues on our radio show today. but they're just interesting because they do evolve regardless of what the situation is, whether it's using internal forces to do a ground survey on a property boundary or whether it's this kind of thing. You know, it always comes up as an issue back and forth. So now when you're talking about the certificate of authorization, I know we only got a little over a minute or so before this next break, but how is that? Is that connected to something else John mentioned to me last week called the 333 exemption process? Is that what the certificate of authorization is about?
No, actually, that's the other way in which you can get approval. So there's a certificate of authorization which is already in place, and there are aircraft. The only way unmanned aircraft are being operated now in the National Airspace System is through the certificate of authorization method. The next opportunity for a use is the Section 333 of that FAA Modernization Reform Act of 2012 that we discussed.
Well, maybe when we come back from the break, we've got a little bit of time before the break, but I don't want to get you in the middle of it and then have to cut you off. So when we come back, maybe you could tell us what that's all about and move forward from there. And then I'm sure there's lots of issues related to this that I'm leaving out just out of my ignorance. So don't wait for me to direct all the conversation because I may not know the right questions to ask. So
sure, that's fine. To answer your question earlier about that Alaskan operation, it was granted to oil company BP for an aerial environment to fly aerial surveys over Alaska's North Slope.
Okay.
It's the Puma AE drone, so that's what the purpose was there, to survey pipelines, roads, and equipment.
People, even the people who haven't been to Alaska, knows it's a really big place, and there's a lot of remote areas where if you wanted to do work in another manner, it would be really hard to get done anyway. So these types of things just add another, I think John used this term last week, another tool in the toolkit. So let's go to our second break, and we'll be right back.
Quick stakes are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden stakes, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about quick stakes, go to www.quickstake.com or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on AmericasWebRadio.com.
Getting into underground utility location? If so, you'll want to know about the Schonstadt Instrument Company's MPC kit, a multi-purpose combo for locating both ferrous objects and underground pipes and cables. And because it consists of two instruments in one package, it qualifies for trade-in allowances on two locators. Any kind, any make, any condition. Contact your dealer for details or visit www.schonstadt.com. That's S-C-H-O-N-S-T-E-D-T.com.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
And we're back with Greg Wynn today talking about UAVs, UAS, from the legal perspective of things. And this is the time of the show when we do our Barker Davis Quick Stakes contest for the week. I'll ask Greg a question, and the first person to reply by email with the answer to that question to quickstakescontest@americaswebradio.com will be our winner for the day. We were talking about the mechanism through which this project in Alaska has been allowed, Greg, and what was that process known as?
Well, the process that the Alaska project was allowed was a certificate of authorization granted by the FAA.
That's the number. That's the answer we're looking for. Certificate of authorization. Thanks for participating in our contest. Just before we were coming back from break, you were mentioning that Amazon has a request in.
Yeah, they petitioned the FAA administrator for an exemption from the regulations to test their unmanned aircraft system for purposes of eventually being able to deliver what they're saying are packages up to 5 pounds in weight within 30 minutes of purchase on their website, which I find very interesting. Actually, they describe the unmanned aircraft system that they intend to use as being capable of, I think, 50 miles per hour in speed. Can't even imagine how they would propose to do that. But the petition for exemption that they sought last week was not to start delivering parcels, but to start the development and research for use of it in their own land. So they just want to be able to operate it to see how it will perform and operate safely. So they wouldn't be doing it for public use at this point. It'll be interesting to see what the FAA does.
To the untrained and uneducated mind about all this, I'm visualizing this picture of multiple UAVs flying around, grasping a little package all over the neighborhood. That sounds a bit intriguing, but maybe it's our future. I don't know. So is the request that they made a COA request, or is it the 333 you were going to talk about?
Right. They made the request for or petition for exemption under Section 333 of the Modernization and Reform Act of 2012. So accordance with, the mandate from Congress, the FAA under Section 333 shall consider, and actually some of the language says, Section 333 provides the authority for the unmanned aircraft system to operate without an airworthiness certification, and that the FAA, in making the determination under subsection A of Section 333, the Secretary of Transportation will consider the size, the weight, the speed, the operational capability, proximity to airports and populated areas, operation within the visual line of sight that shall not create a hazard to the user of the national airspace system or the public or pose a threat to national security. So these are some of the important buzzwords the FAA is looking for when an entity will petition under Section 333 for an exemption to operate.
And is that something that is people are applying for, or was the Amazon the first one since we're so new into this? Do you have any information about that?
I do. I know that I was talking to the FAA last week. I was told that I had filed on behalf of the client, I think, the 12th petition for exemption under Section 333. But having said that, we know that the Motion Picture Association, which filed before I filed mine, I think filed 7. So the Motion Picture Association itself, on behalf of its members, filed sort of a master petition for exemption, and then I think 5 or 6 other individual studios, whether it's TV or film studio, petition again in accordance with the same Motion Picture Association petition. So that was like 7 or 8 there. So theoretically, I was within the first 5 that had been filed, and I think Amazon probably is within the first 20. So I don't know how many there are as of today.
Wow. So with your speaking about having filed one, would that mean that someone in your situation with your firm, if somebody out there was interested in pursuing this, would they go through someone like you primarily to do that? Is that the best route to take? I assume it is. People that know what they're talking about.
Right. That is the best route. For instance, we took a look at some of the other petitions that have been filed. The Motion Picture Association went through a law firm. Obviously my client went through our law firm. You know, having worked, and by the way, the one from Amazon was written in-house by Amazon, one of the VPs there. It's a little bit different in its approach and its layout. But, you know, having worked at the headquarters level at FAA and having had a meeting with the exact office that will be considering the petition, I have a good insight as to what the FAA is looking for and how best to get something like this through the procedural nightmare that it could be sometimes when trying to get the approval for something as new as this. Keep in mind, this is the first time it's ever been done. There's no filed road for anybody to follow at this point. So my advice is to, you know, seek as few exceptions as possible, meaning if the FAA is telling us eventually they're going to want a commercial pilot, commercially certificated pilot to operate the unmanned aircraft system with, by the way, a second-class airman medical certificate, which is required to exercise the privileges of a commercial pilot certificate, then let's say we will use a commercial pilot. Some of the petitions I've read that have been filed are seeking a waiver from that. They're saying, well, we'd like to operate it by somebody that's not a commercial pilot. Well, again, right off the bat, you're asking for more than really the FAA may be willing to grant. Also, the airworthiness certification of the aircraft, we ask for airworthiness certification where we will have a licensed airframe and power plant mechanic go ahead and certify this aircraft as airworthy, where other petitions I've seen are seeking a waiver from that requirement. Again, the more you ask for from the FAA, I think it would be the harder to get that approval.
Yeah, that really makes a lot of sense because, as in any other approval process, regardless of at what level, the easier you make it for the people who are going to approve it in terms of, this is going to sound worse than I want it to sound, but in terms of the work they have to do to figure out what you're actually doing. If you're hitting all the right checkoff boxes, then I would makes perfect sense that you'd get a better result in a quicker amount of time.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, that's my advice, and certainly my law firm is capable, ready, able, and willing to assist with that task, and having done it and knowing the process, the procedure, and the people involved. It's the path of least resistance rather than sort of trying to reinvent the wheel without, you know, having any knowledge of what happens behind the scenes. I always say, you know, to my clients, it's like, you know, your 4 or 5-year-old comes to you and asks you for a cookie, and you say, certainly you can have a cookie, but if they ask for the whole box, you say, well, wait a minute, no, it's not going to work. And that's what I think some of these companies out there are doing. They're asking the FAA for the whole box of cookies, and I think the likelihood of them getting that is you know, slim to none.
Yeah, and for folks in our business, that resonates in a little different way, too, because so many of our people will apply to do work for an agency, whether it be local, state, or federal. And as you mentioned when you first started talking about this, knowing their terminology and sure, being able to state things in a way that makes sense to them is always critical.
Sure.
Whether you think it makes sense or not, or you phrase it differently than you might in a conversation with another professional in your realm, if you present it in a way that they can understand, then this sounds like a very similar process.
Right. And the other part of that is, you know, making it easy, again, for the FAA to say, yes, it's okay. You know, if you're going to propose an operation, be specific about where, when, and how you're going to operate. Don't go in and ask for the whole state of Oklahoma, for instance, because that will never happen. You'll never get authority for that. And more importantly, the aircraft that you intend to use, based upon your mission requirements, you know, how fast, how much weight, load it needs to carry, the altitude, and how long it needs to stay aloft, take a look at some of the aircraft that are presently being operated under a certificate of authorization on behalf of a public entity, and use that aircraft and say to the FAA, look, you know, you've already approved this for use. It's already flying in the National Airspace System, albeit it's through a certificate of authorization, we're just asking for the same airworthiness approval. Somebody's already proven to you that it's safe and airworthy, so that's what we intend to do.
And it sounds like that in terms of this a specialty, maybe it's a good terminology to use here. If you know, one were going to do a particular type of work, maybe they, if they were going to be in real estate, they'd go to a real estate attorney. If they were going to be in some other business aspect, they'd go to an attorney that knew more about that. So it makes sense to go to here, to not just go to the local guy down the street who probably never done this in his life. You need to go to somebody that really knows what they're doing, how this works.
Absolutely. And a lot of times my firm is retained for a client through either their general counsel, so they have a lawyer on staff, and that lawyer knows enough that he or she doesn't know enough to handle this type of work, so they'll retain us, or the law firms that don't do this on a daily basis. I mean, you know, I have a pretty boutique law practice that for 25 years exclusively practiced aviation law. So absolutely, you know, I wouldn't tackle a difficult real estate issue. I'd go to a real estate lawyer or somebody with a specialty in the area that I'm dealing with.
Is that specialty your specialty? Obviously, we have listeners today from all across the country. So if somebody in a Colorado or wherever was going to be involved in this, how would they find somebody? Is there an association, or how do they find somebody who has this specialty?
Well, we're calling it a specialty. In effect, it is, but it's not recognized as a specialty. It's a concentration in aviation law. You know, and aviation lawyers, and I always like to say, you know, don't grow on trees. Most of us, myself included, began as pilots, a lot of the military flyers. I have 35 years as an aviator, commercial pilot. I've been a flight instructor for 30 of those years. And again, important based on the type of work that you're asking your aviation attorney to handle, does that person have government experience? If it's going to be a regulatory issue, like a petition for exemption. So a lot of us did work at the FAA or the U.S. Department of Justice Aviation Litigation Division, or both, like I did myself. So again, based on the particular scenario that you're dealing with, the particular issue that is important to you, find out that your lawyer does have that background. And because of this, the concentration of an aviation lawyer and the type of work that we do, we work nationally, which is interesting. Most, you know, the trust in the states, divorce law, criminal law, you need to get somebody that's licensed in the jurisdiction in which your issue is pending, okay? If it's a Maryland state cause of action, you need to have a Maryland licensed attorney. My law practice operates nationwide and worldwide on regulatory matters involving aviation. And we're able to do that because it's a federal issue. It's an administrative issue. So, yeah, I have clients in Colorado. We have clients in California. We have clients overseas. And so, you know, it don't feel like you need to stay local when it comes to a very complicated and intricate issue involving the FAA and the Department of Transportation.
Well, that's good advice. So people will have some idea that there, and in all likelihood, there may not be somebody right down the street. So we're right at our last break here in probably a minute or so. But when we come back in our last segment, maybe we can talk about your crystal ball looking into the future, and maybe even talk about some pitfalls that people might need to know about.
Sure.
Attention surveyors, are you aware that yellow stick you're using is saving lives all over the world? Yes, that Pinfinder is clearing fields and villages of unexploded cluster bombs and other hidden explosives in over 25 countries. Johnstead, in cooperation with international mine action programs, provides free locators to where they are most urgently needed. To find out how you can help, visit the NSPS website at nsps.us.com. And thank you.
Quick stakes are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden stakes, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about quick stakes, go to www.quickstake.com, or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
And here's something new from Schonstedt. Did you know that Schonstedt has upped the ante on trade-ins? Now you can trade in any instrument, theirs or a competitor's, in any condition, working or not, and receive more in trade than ever before. Plus, they'll pay the freight both ways. Contact your local dealer for details or go to Schonstedt.com. That's S-C-H-O-N-S-T-E-D-T.com.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We're back for our last segment with Greg Winton today, and we've been talking about the UAVs, UAS systems. And before we went to break, you were talking about the practice that you guys are in. I guess maybe in this last segment you could talk to our audience a little bit about what you're thinking. You've obviously involved in this very much, and I don't know what your crystal ball looks like on where this might be heading, or if you think it's going to become a pervasive kind of thing, or maybe even talk to some of our folks about what pitfalls they might look for if they're thinking about doing this.
Well, absolutely. And interestingly enough, we're all kind of guessing and wondering what's going to happen next, including, I think, people inside the FAA at the headquarters level. We do know that the notice of proposed rulemaking for the UAS, unmanned aircraft system regulations, should be published sometime before the end of 2014. So, we're five months away from that. And I've been told unofficially that if a petition for exemption to operate an unmanned aircraft system commercially is made before the notice of proposed rulemaking is published, the FAA will consider that petition in accordance with Section 333 and either grant the approval or, I assume, deny. But what I was also told is once the notice of proposed rulemaking is published in the Federal Register, that's the time in which notice and comment period takes place. So the FAA will be accepting written notice and comments from the public and from industry. If you file a petition for exemption after the notice of proposed rulemaking is published, the FAA will not consider that petition for exemption in accordance with Section 333, if that makes sense. They're going to use it as your comment to the proposed rulemaking, which means you're never going to be considered to be able to operate pursuant to an exemption. So you miss the window is what I'm saying. So since we were told before the end of 2014, it could be tomorrow, it could be December 31st, we don't know, but my advice would be if you're even considering petitioning for an exemption to operate an unmanned aircraft system commercially, get that petition together fairly quickly and get it on file with the FAA before they close that window. We don't know how many are going to be filed between now and the end of December. We don't know. I assume it's first in, first out, but I don't know that to be a fact. I do have a strong suspicion, knowing the way that the government works at the headquarters level, that if you have a concise petition for exemption in a proper format that the FAA is looking for with the necessary information laid out properly, that it may be considered a faster basis than one that is not conforming to the regulatory scheme. Now, go ahead. You got a question?
No, go ahead. I'll ask the question later.
Sure. Okay. So what we do know about this petition for exemption scenario is that it's already been in place. So, for instance, if I build my own aircraft, experimental aircraft, and it only has one set of controls, but it has two seats, can I receive flight instruction in that aircraft? There's a regulation that actually says to receive flight instruction, the aircraft shall have dual controls, meaning so your instructor can take over in a situation where it may. You would ask the FAA, petition them for an exemption from that regulation, and in some cases it will be granted. That's 14 Code of Federal Regulation Part 11. That's already been in place. That's the same vehicle that the FAA has asked us to petition for exemption from these UAS rules so that we can operate commercially. So the FAA tells us in Part 11, you shall petition for exemption 120 days prior to the operation that you're seeking an exemption for. Well, that 120-day sort of written policy that the FAA has adopted, will that apply to the petition for exemption to operate an unmanned aircraft system commercially in the National Airspace System? That's a good question. We don't know the answer to that. I think the oldest petition is probably about 30 days old now. Ours is probably 20 days. So will the FAA give us an answer in the 120-day period? I don't know the answer to that. We're all kind of, again, waiting on that to see where it goes. And will the FAA just accept or deny your petition for exemption, or will they get back to you and say, well, we need more information before we can grant this exemption? Oh, they just deny it and not give you a reason why, and now you just lost 120 days. It's a long time. It's 4 months, quarter of a year. So all of these types of questions are really on everybody's mind. The window is closing for the opportunity. So if I lost 4 months because I didn't fill out my or didn't submit my petition properly, that can be devastating to my operation. So you really want to consider that if you're a company considering this, and you know, get the proper legal team together, get the proper technical team together, and get your petition on file as soon as possible.
Well, through either the certificates of authorization or the 333 process or the soon-to-be final process, if that's the right terminology, is there a set of guidelines? And I ask this question because professional surveyors have sets of guidelines that are mandated to them by the states in which they're licensed. You know, you do these things, you do it this way, and not every aspect of it, but there's general guidelines you have to follow and adhere to. Is that going to be the case here? I assume there will be, or is it already there through the COA or the 333 process?
Well, yeah, if you look at, again, 14 CFR Part 11, which is part of the Federal Aviation Regulations, it's entitled the Petition for Exemption, it pretty much lays out almost in a question and answer format what you need to do. That's the protocol to get to where you need to be through this exemption process. But knowing the type of information to provide is something that is very specific. And again, if you're not familiar with it, you might not know. And there's no guidebook written on it. Just be very careful in the way in which you put together this operational scenario.
Yeah, I was actually thinking more of after the fact. After you've been given permission to go ahead, is there a rule book or a guideline book that says you have to operate this particular way? For example, in surveying, you have to, meet certain precision requirements in your surveys and that kind of thing, follow certain rules.
Sure. Well, again, because, there is no history, so we don't know. We haven't seen the FAA approve one of these operations under this particular scenario. We don't know the answer to that. But however, again, I advise my clients that if we're going to seek that petition for exemption, yes, you'd be very specific. And we provide an operations manual, a general operational procedures, so that the FAA knows this is how we're going to handle it, a safety management system. This is how we're going to operate the aircraft so that it's safe. This is how the operation is going to be safe. Here are all the fail-safes if something happens that was unexpected, unanticipated. So, I would encourage anybody seeking a petition for exemption to think about those operational requirements and specifications and include them in your petition. But there's no, one-size-fits-all. It's got to be very specific for each operator, for each specific operation.
Right. So it's for lack of a better term, it's a practice manual per project almost that you're going to, instead of having a blanket rule that says in every case you have to do this, you're talking more in terms of this is the manner in which I'm going to approach this particular job.
Correct. And having said that, right now MAPS, for instance, its members, a lot of them do somewhat similar work. So, you're not going to reinvent the wheel every time because it's still going to wind up being round and rolled just perfectly. So I'm working with MAPS to try to put together a safety management system plan for operation of unmanned aircraft system in the National Airspace System so that we can say to our members, look, we've already sort of come up with a template that the FAA likes and uses and approves and will appreciate you using in your plan of action so that not everybody has to come up with their own SMS. So that's on the table right now that we're discussing, we're working on.
Thinking of licensing, and this is an issue that I wouldn't expect you would know the answer to, but it just came to me as we were talking about the whole licensing thing. In the surveying profession, one has to hold a license in the state in which the project exists. And so what I'm wondering is if you're going to do certain things. Now, you can gather a lot of data without a surveyor's license, no question about that. But if it's related to surveying-type activities, so I guess I'm wondering how that would play into approvals or whether they – I guess that might be a job-by-job thing again in terms of whether you require a licensed professional surveyor to be in charge of the work for the licensing side of things. And in this case, I'm talking licensing in terms of professional practice, not in flying side.
Right. I mean, keep in mind, for my purposes, I'm involved in the FAA authorization, certification, approval process. The FAA is not the one that requires the surveyor to have, you know, specific state licensing, right?
Right.
It's a different authority. So I don't expect that would change at all, but that's not an FAA matter.
Right, and now that I'm thinking about it, it goes to some of the overall mapping that happens. You know, even in a state or county level, they might do some resource type mapping that they don't need a professional surveyor, and many other cases they do. So, that
right.
I would imagine this would fall under the exact same scenario.
Sure.
We've got a minute or a minute and a half left. So before we get off the air, I want to thank you for being with me today. It's been very enlightening to hear about what's going on, and I know that our listeners are excited about it. They're being given, or I won't say inundated with, but given information at their surveyor conferences about using the UAV, UAS systems, and I know they're really excited about it. So finding out more information about applying and where the rules are likely to go sometime in the near future is very helpful to them, so I really appreciate that.
Yeah, my pleasure. You know, it's an exciting time in aviation, and we're looking forward to see how these things play out in the near future.
Yeah, it's the thing that's so interesting for us in the surveying profession is that over the last 40 years or so, our profession has changed so dramatically from where it was hundreds of years before that, right up until that time, and then all of a sudden new technology comes in and just creates a whole new landscape, and this is just part of that. So we get excited about all these things whenever they happen, and then once the excitement sort of goes into, well, how do I utilize it, then we have to start thinking more diligently about how we're going to incorporate all these things. So
sure.
It's good to have the information, and great luck, by the way, out on your new office. I'm envious of your view out the window out there in Annapolis. So. But it's been really great to have you on the show, and I think we're about to the time we need to sign off. So again, appreciate it, and I'll stay in touch, and if we can find out more information as it goes along, or more information is available, maybe we can chat again.
Absolutely. And any of your listeners who need me, it's Greg Winton at the Aviation Law Firm. Thanks.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
You bet. Bye.
Take care.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.